then, at dinner time, you and I will retire to begin our talks.
Sloane braces.
I did not come here to have a party, Chancellor. I would prefer to move straight to business.
Your attaché said your presence here deserved pomp and circumstance, as is the way of one sovereign entity greeting another.
Sloane shoots Adia a look.
The girl made a mistake, and she will be chastised for it. Now, however, is not the time. Instead, Sloane turns, forces a smile.
Yes, perhaps she is right. We are all owed a moment of leisure. Thank you for hosting these talks, Chancellor. Shall we begin?
Chapter 35. The transport eases in through the mouth of the hangar bay, settling into the belly of the Star Destroyer Dominion. Joran Turnbull, or rather Sinji Arath Velis once again, borrowing the identity of an Imperial agent who died on the Endor moon, eases back on the throttle. His teeth gritting so hard, he's afraid they might be ground to a fine white powder.
"This is a terrible plan,"
he says to Han Solo. Solo, who crouches down so as not to be seen. Han Solo, the jerk. The very handsome, very charismatic jerk.
"And I hate you very much."
"Relax. This is gonna work."
The transport thuds dully against the hangar bay. Sinjir isn't much of a pilot, and his landing is clumsier than a drunken dragon snake the way it just sort of flops down. But nobody cares, blessedly. And in moments, the ship is surrounded by a whole bloody battalion of stormtroopers. Oh, and what's this? Here comes Admiral Orlan himself. Well then, Orlan must be eager to collect his prize, the prize of the rebel hero Han Solo. In the back, behind the sealed door separating the cockpit of the transport from the hold, comes the sound. It's a sound Sinjir has been hearing during the whole flight from the surface of Kashyyyk. A susurrus of shifting and clicking. Each time he hears it, he flinches.
"You ready?"
Solo asks.
"No, not for this."
He blanches. His guts feel like water. His skin prickles.
"I should have known this was a bad plan as soon as you told me what captives we'd be transporting. You're a dangerous man."
Solo shrugs.
Outside, a thumping. A stormtrooper pounding on the side of the transport. Over the comm, the voice of Lieutenant Yoff.
"Open!"
"Here goes,"
Solo says.
"Yes,"
Sinjir says grimly, then opens the door. Sinjir winces and waits. He flips the exterior hatch port cam on, though he really doesn't want to see. But it's like looking at a speeder crash. It's hard to look away. On the screen, Orlan seems confused at the lack of anything happening. Though surely by now, he's hearing the sounds.
Those terrible sounds.
Instead of flinching away like a smart person, the fool actually leans in. It happens so fast, Orlan doesn't even get to scream. He reels back, clutching his eyes as if something was flung into them. Hairs, Sinjir knows, flung from the legs and thorax of the massive web-weaver spider that now pounces on Orlan. The spider is not alone. Others join it, leaping and scuttling forth, bristling legs pinning stormtroopers to the deck of the bay. Glistening chelicerae click and chitter as fangs emerge and punch holes clean through white armor. The screams of troopers dissolve into gargling bleats as they flail and fall. The spiders scuttle and shriek and pounce. The admiral tries to run. Sinjir watches him out the front window of the shuttle. But Orlan, he's blinded, and the spider does not care to relinquish its prey. It knocks him down, and
two fangs crunch through the officer's skull.
"Spiders!"
Sinjir grouses.
"Why exactly are we using spiders again?"
Solo shrugs.
"Wookiee said it would work.
wasn't too much of a thing to secure this gaggle. And, well, look.
He spreads his arms out to behold the bedlam. Stormtroopers fruitlessly fire their blasters as officers flee. Spiders fling themselves bodily against them. Screams and flailing ensue.
All right, this distraction won't last long. Let's do this.
He slides into the cockpit and mans the weapons control. The sides of the shuttle bang as the laser cannons flanking the cockpit emerge. Ahead, a pair of ship-sized turrets wait to take out any trespassing crafts. And next to them sit the hangar bay shield generators. Han pulls the trigger once, twice, three times. Red light screams above the bodies of the spider-pinned stormtroopers, and both the turrets and the shield generators explode in a rain of white light. Parts of them rain down in a clatter. Sinjir signals to the comm. Halo, doors open. No need to knock.
Come on,
Solo says. I'm not going out there.
Yes, you are.
There are spiders out there. Not little spiders. Spiders as big as my grandmother. And while my grandmother was a fairly small woman, she was still considerably larger than any other spider ever.
They're occupied.
Occupied?
Eating stormtroopers.
Did I mention I hate you?
Maybe once or twice.
Sinjir growls. Then gets up. They pop the door between the cockpit and the transport hold. His breath catches in his chest and won't release because... Spiders, spiders, there are so many spiders! Willing his legs to carry him outside the transport feels like a truly heroic act. Yet somehow he manages. And sure enough, there is one of those web weavers. It rises on its two hind legs. Its hairs bristle. Green ichor drips from fangs that pop free of its mouth parts like sprung traps. Solo shoots it in the face. Something squirts out of the top of its head and drops, twitching. Two more spiders come scurrying up behind it. Sinjir fumbles for his own blaster, but it doesn't matter. Spears of laser light rip into them as the roar of the Halo's engines fill the bay. The gunship blasts forward, coming in close behind the transport, its turbines turning fast as it lands with a bone-jarring bang. In moments, the others are rushing off the Halo. Jazz, Jom, and of course Chewbacca. Weapons drawn and already firing. Spiders bowl over, squirting fluid. Stormtroopers tumble and fall.
Come on!
Solo waves them forward and whoops.
Let's steal ourselves a Star Destroyer.
Sinjir stifles a groan.
Don't worry, Han smirks. I've done this before. What could go wrong?
The logistics of this plan defy reality, Sinjir knows. A Star Destroyer is home to thousands. This one is running light, admittedly, so its numbers are in the hundreds. But their one moment of arachnid distraction earns them precious little time. And piloting a Star Destroyer isn't exactly the same thing as weaving a gunship or a freighter through a nest of TIE fighters. Admittedly, Sinjir has never piloted a Star Destroyer, but he wagers it's a lot like trying to saddle and ride a stampeding trog beast. So he's pretty sure this won't work. Though as they fight through the hallways and channels of the destroyer, working their way toward the bridge of the ship, he starts to feel uncharacteristically optimistic. Fighting alongside Solo means some of the smuggler's trademark luck seems to rub off, like a curiously pleasant smell. Jazz takes down troopers left and right with her slug thrower. Jom is altogether more brutal. He and the Wookiee get right in there, scrapping bodily with their folks, flinging white armored incompetents left and right and often into one another. And then, as if by miracle, or by the Force, or whatever bizarre cosmic authority governs the weave and weft of the galaxy, they are on the bridge. And Solo is waving around a pair of blasters, saying,
"This is a robbery. We're gonna need this Star Destroyer."
And for a moment, all looks bright and shining. The comm officers and ensigns start to stand, hands up. An older, paunchy officer with Vice Admiral bars on his chest hesitates before finally standing up. Sinjir thinks, "My word, we've done it." But the thought of victory comes just a moment too early. The door behind them blasts open, and more stormtroopers pour onto the bridge. The fight Sinjir thought was over suddenly follows them inside. Jom gets his blaster shot out of his hands, and so lurches forward while swinging a fist. But the commando catches the end of a rifle to the throat, and he falls. Jazz replaces him. Her rifle is too long to fire easily in such a tight fray, but she swings it like a club. Sinjir does his own work, too. He gets behind one trooper and stabs the flat of his hand just under the poor dolt's helmet. The tips of his fingers drive hard into the trooper's neck, and it has the expected result. The Imperial soldier's fingers fly open on reflex, and the rifle he's carrying clatters to the ground. "Ha ha!" he thinks. "Our luck holds true once." A jarring hit from behind. Sinjir's teeth clap together over his tongue. He tastes blood and sees stars going supernova behind his eyes as he drops face forward onto the floor. A stormtrooper steps over him and kicks him in the ribs. Oof! Through blurry eyes, he sees troopers swarming Solo, taking his blaster. Chewie too, and the Wookiee roars in protest. "It's over," he thinks. He watches as the stormtrooper slams Solo against a console. A pair of troopers stun Chewie as the Wookiee storms forward. A boot finds Sinjir's neck and presses down. Luck, it seems, is a finite resource after all.
Chapter 36. Liberation Day has begun. Right now, a parade marches down the center of Hana City, a line of musical clamor and bright colors. Holographic dancers march alongside a very real Chandrillan band. Oompas from bladderpipes, booms from the tumble drums, the clapping of hands and the stomping of marching feet. Even from where Wedge Antilles sits, up on a balcony overlooking the day's events, he hears it. He smells food, too. A dozen odors commingling in his nose, thanks to food vendors scattered throughout the city. Dermic spice and chando peppers, vent grilled blackbeaks and pickled blackbeak eggs, baked sour tarts and crispy mallow dainties. He should be down there. Not eating or watching the parade, no. He should be working. Flying sorties. Keeping an eye on things. But they told him to take it easy. He helped plan, they said, so now it was time to relax and enjoy the day. And yet he can't. He wants to stay busy. Wedge wants to do his damn job. He winces as he pulls away from the balcony. His leg and hip ache. Less today than yesterday, though. That's something. At his table, a blinking light indicates an incoming message. He hobbles over, sets it to play. Leia's face appears. It's a recorded message, not live. As she speaks, his blood goes cold. Then it goes hot.
"Captain Antilles, I've gone and done something foolish. I've jumped ahead to a meeting point just outside the Kashyyyk system. I'm in the Millennium Falcon and have Yvonne Verlaine as my co-pilot. We will soon make our way into Kashyyyk orbit. If we are alone, I expect that the Empire will win the day and take me as a prisoner. A very important prisoner, and one that would represent a great loss to the New Republic. Unless, of course, someone might want to intervene. I could use some company out here, Captain. Care to join us?"
And then her face shimmers and is gone.
"Oh, Leia, what are you doing?"
His heart pounds in his chest like a pulse cannon. Wedge throws on his coat and grabs his cane.
Every free moment she has, Sloane gives Adia the look.
The one that says, this parade, this music, this noise and clamor, it's all your fault. To her credit, Adia looks starkly chastened, as she should. Meanwhile, Sloane is strapped in for this unpleasant ride. The Empire is no stranger to celebrations. Parades are a necessity to keep the populace docile. Yes, yes, citizens, eat your sweet treats and enjoy the show. But Imperial parades are restrained affairs. They put forth processions of officers and troopers. Bands play the known marches, suitable patriotic marches. Such celebrations are short and simple. This, however, is a sloppy, egregious affair. Right now, half-dressed acrobats are passing beneath Sloane's balcony seat. They're flipping and flopping about on poles, jumping back and forth from grab bounce to grab bounce, holographic streamers trailing behind. It is clownish and bizarre. Then, thrumming by on a hovering stage, comes a martial demonstration from the Mon Cala, admittedly impressive, given that they are essentially an underwater race of squid people. Trailing after them is yet another band, this one playing the execrable ear-horror music of the Gabdorans. Sitting to her right is the Chancellor. Adia is to her left. Her guards are present by the door, though the room is home to thrice as many New Republic soldiers.
It's something, isn't it?
Mon Mothma says, and it occurs to Sloane the woman really means it. She is earnest. Many politicians put forward false faces, and that rarely settles well with Sloane. But the Chancellor's authenticity, for lack of a better word, also unsettles her.
It is something. Let's talk for a moment. I want to lay it all on the table before the official talks begin. Before we have a scribe of record and the messy work of figuring out the parameters of our treaty.
I will lay it all out for you, Sloane thinks.
I believe your way of life is naive. I fear you will bring chaos to the galaxy. I think the only messy work here will be cleaning up the dung heap you've built by conjuring this terrible vacuum of power. We kept order. You will keep only disarray.
She speaks no such truth, of course. Instead, Sloane simply says,
I would rather sit back and enjoy the show, if you don't mind.
It's a lie. It's very difficult to enjoy Gabdoran music, which sounds not unlike a chorus of animals caught in various sharp-toothed traps, struggling and failing to find freedom. But the Chancellor is persistent.
The show is part of it. The galaxy is a myriad wonderful place. It is home to such wild miscellany. Present here is individuality. Something the Empire, I feel, has missed. If there is to be any kind of treaty, it is vital we preserve what makes life in this galaxy special. It is critical we preserve all of what you will see on display. All ways of existence. All the choices for all of us.
Oh, absolutely,
Sloane lies. Every molecule of her body is straining not to taunt the Chancellor with the news that soon an attack will be incoming. And all the ships in the Empire's fleet will make short work of this world. And that the New Republic will fall to its knees. Individuality is a fine crusade if you're an idiot. Joining the collective and supporting the greater good through Imperial control, that takes true grit and real wisdom. She cannot say those things. So instead she picks a different scab.
I don't see your Alderaanian princess here.
That scores a direct hit. The Chancellor shifts uncomfortably in her seat.
Leia is ill today, I'm afraid.
A shame.
I often feel that she and I were matched, by the fates, I mean, against each other. She and I dueling across the hollow waves. I would have liked to have met her in person. Yes, She is the voice and the face of the New Republic, as I am of my empire.
Just then, the door behind them opens. A man stands there with dark hair and a rust-red Republic flight suit. He leans on his cane and then looks to Sloane. It takes their eyes meeting to realize who she's even looking at. Wedge Antilles. He's the pilot she had laid out before her in the satrap's palace on Akiva. The way he leans on his cane, she sees now that she truly broke him. An odd worm of guilt crawls through her heart. He was just a pawn in this game. She was too, in a sense, and she regrets what happened to him. The way he looks at her, he wishes his eyes were spears, each of them piercing clean through her chest. He doesn't just want to kill her. He wants to end her. She doesn't blame him. And at least that anger tells her that she helped break his body, but not his spirit. Good for him. Fool though he may be for serving the Republic. The Chancellor excuses herself and hurries over to him. They speak in hushed tones, but the tension there is difficult to hide. To Adia, Sloane whispers, "The Chancellor appears rattled."
"She does a little."
"Something that pilot said is upsetting her." Mothma throws her a glance, then pulls the pilot back outside the room. Adia says,
"I'm sure it's nothing."
"They may know something."
"They couldn't."
"Why?"
"Because they're not smart enough,"
Adia says. Something about that sticks between Sloane's teeth. Not smart enough? She prides herself on being smart. The smartest in the room. But a trickle of doubt begins to creep into her mind. She has little time to ruminate upon it, though, because the Chancellor comes back into the room. Mothma is now off-kilter, though she's straining not to show that to Sloane.
"Apologies,"
the Chancellor says.
"Is everything all right?"
"Of course. Why wouldn't it be?"
Gallius Rax watches the events in Hana City. He has no special access. He doesn't need it. The Chancellor controls the HoloNet now, and is broadcasting her Liberation Day across the waves. It is quite the show. A demonstration from an arrogant bird.
"Look how pretty my tail feathers are."
The parade ends, and slowly they clear the Senate Plaza. A stage is elevated from the stone. It rises not with any new technology, but by men who dutifully crank old wooden handles, turning ancient stone gears. Chandrila is an old world. Modern tastes clash with a long history. If they're bringing out the stage, then soon it will be time to fill it. Which means it is also time to orchestrate the plan. He summons Grand Moff Rand to his chamber.
"Sir,"
Rand says, compliant and cold,
"prepare the fleets to move on my command."
Rax hands over a data pad.
"When I give the say-so, direct them to these coordinates."
"All of them."
"Coordinate with Borum, too. We'll need everyone on the ground there with everything we have." "Everything."
"But, sir, this isn't..."
"I know. Just do it."
"Does Sloane know?"
"She will. They all will, in fact. Summon them. I wish to meet with my Shadow Council."
He waves his hand.
"Now go."
In the meantime, Rax turns his attention back to the events in Hana City. It is time to watch his opera unfold.
Chapter 37.
"I failed."
Those two words race each other in the front of Han Solo's mind like a couple of pod racers jockeying for position. He came out here, leaving Leia and the New Republic for one reason, and that was to do what nobody else wanted to do, save Kashyyyk. Leaving Leia behind like that was hell on him. But she understood. She knows what it is to have a cause bigger than yourself. If anybody gets it, Leia does.
I failed.
Even as the gruff Vice Admiral commands stormtroopers to pick him up, which they do handily, he plays through the list of failures. He trusted Imra, but she was bad news and he was too dumb to see it. The Empire snapped up Chewie and Han got away. And then he was close, so close to fixing it all. They fought their way across half a planet and took out Lozan Tolruk just in time for him to bomb the planet to splinters and mud. And, he reminds himself woefully, Wookiee blood.
It's all my fault.
The others are in shackles now. The Bounty Hunter, the Commando, the Ex-Imperial. And once again, and worst of all, his co-pilot, Chewie. They were a good team. They did right by him. They did right by Chewie. All of them are shoved forward, pressed against the wall, Solo included. Behind him, the Vice Admiral steps up. His breath smells like rot. The man stinks of sweat.
These Imperials have really let themselves go.
The Vice Admiral growls in his ear.
My name is Vice Admiral Dom Corgale. You should get to know that name, villain. I'm going to be the one to deliver you into the Empire's embrace. You will make a most excellent bargaining chip at the table. You alone will buy me a seat.
Tuska Chai money,
Solo says, a Huttese curse that's about the worst he can muster. Something about the man's mother and a Tusken raider chief.
Don't you get it? You lost! You're not the other side in a war, fella. You're criminals!
Then, as criminals, you won't mind if I spare you, but execute your friends, here and now?
Corgale twirls his fingers in the air, and the stormtroopers press blaster barrels against the backs of the heads of those pressed against the wall.
It's been fun, everyone,
Sinjir says, cheeks smashed against the wall. Jom and Jazz stay silent, struggling futilely against their captors. Chewie rumbles a low growl.
I know, pal. We tried.
From across the room, one of the comm officers calls over.
Sir, we have an incoming ship dropping out of hyperspace.
What?
Corgale says. Then his voice lifts.
I asked for reinforcements. Perhaps now that Orlan is dead, they've listened.
It's not one of ours. It's a freighter. Old Corellian make.
Han's eyes jolt open. He looks to Chewie as she says the rest.
A YT-1300.
He mouths the words to his co-pilot. The Falcon. But who the hell is piloting it? Wexley?
The craft is hailing us,
the comm officer says.
Put it through, Corgale says. But then launch a contingent of TIE fighters. We must take no chances.
Over the calm comes a voice that lifts Han Solo's heart the same time as it sinks it.
This is Leia Organa of the New Republic. You will stand down your ships or you will be destroyed.
Corgale's paunch shudders as he offers one stiff laugh.
One craft. She thinks she can take down three Star Destroyers with one rattle-trap freighter? Is she daft? Let the TIE fighters cut her to pieces. She's not even a pilot. She's a politician.
Han grins ear to ear.
You've never seen a politician like this before.
But in the back of his mind, he can't help but wonder, how does she plan on doing this alone? Yvonne Verlaine gives her a look. No, not a look, but rather that look. An all-too-familiar arched eyebrow and smug smirk, and a gaze pregnant with the question, What have you gotten us into this time, Princess? Leia isn't quite sure. For a moment she feels overexposed. A tooth without its enamel. A ship without its armor. Like she alone is dangling out in space on a tether.
maybe this wasn't a very good idea.
Dead ahead, the Dominion begins spitting TIE fighters into the black.
Leia, we're about to have company,
Yvonne says. She doesn't mean the TIE fighters. Sensors indicate incoming ships. A dozen stars behind the Falcon zoom close. Stars that aren't stars at all. Ships. Starfighters. X-Wings. She actually flinches as they swoop down out of hyperspace and zip past the Falcon on all sides, their cannons flashing. A TIE fighter rockets forth, going the other direction, fire belching from its top just before it implodes. Over Leia's comms comes the voice of Wedge Antilles.
This is Phantom Leader. Phantom Squadron's got your back, General Organa. Let's save the day and bring it home.
Corgale sucks in a small intake of breath. A moment of weakness that Solo detects. A moment of fear. Han likes that moment. He likes the moment that comes next even better. Because Corgale snarls,
A dozen X-Wings and a crippled freighter is all they've brought? We have 3 Star Destroyers! Call the Vitiator and the Neutralizer. Time to eliminate this cloud of flies before...
Another ship comes into view. What follows is the moment Solo truly enjoys. As the Vice Admiral makes a tiny little whimper sound. Like vermin caught in a trap. The comms come alive with the sound of Admiral Akbar's voice.
This is New Republic Fleet Admiral Akbar, commanding the Mon Cala cruiser Home 1. Surrender or be destroyed.
Corgale paces, nostrils flaring, cheeks puffing out. He speaks to no one but himself as he runs through the motions.
We can't surrender. We must mount a vigorous defense. G-5623 is our world, and it's still 3 ships against their 1.
Chewbacca is apparently done with it. All of it. The Wookiee roars, swinging his head around and connecting with the helmet of the stormtrooper holding the hairy beast against the wall. The trooper cries out and tumbles to the floor, and the Wookiee kicks away from the wall, charging toward Corgale. The other stormtroopers turn, rifles up.
They're gonna shoot Chewie.
Han gets underneath the trooper closest to him and slams the man up and forward. He careers into the next. Sinjir ducks and darts out with his foot, hooking it behind another Imperial's knee and dropping him. Jom and Jazz take out the last together, each crushing the trooper between them. When he falls, they stomp and kick until he's still. Chewie completes his trajectory. He hits Corgale like a crashing ship. The man bleats and falls. The Wookiee roars in triumph. Outside, on the viewscreen, the X-Wings swoop and pivot even as the Vitiator moves closer, and the Neutralizer moves in beyond that. One of the Phantom Squadron ships is shredded by a trio of TIE fighters on its tail, even as the Falcon cuts in and takes them out a few seconds too late. Solo knows that Corgale was right. They do have 3 Star Destroyers. The odds are still against them. It's like a long game of Savak. When the chips are down and you have squat for cards, what can you do? You even the odds. And the way Han likes to even the odds is by cheating. Jazz, panting, stands next to him, her hair plastered down on her thorny head horns.
What's our next move, Solo?
Won't be long before we've got stormtroopers all over this bridge,
he says.
We need to take control of this bridge and lock it down. But first, that means we gotta find a way to get these binders off.
Chewie yawps, then bares his teeth as he wrenches his arms apart. The shackles snap like they were made of brittle candy instead of steel.
That works, Solo says.
Chewie moves to help Solo and the others with their cuffs. Jom says,
I got the door,
and then heads over to lock it down. Sinjir and Jazz reapply the cuffs to the knocked-out stormtroopers, but one person is missing. Corgale. He's nowhere on the bridge. That pig wriggled away. No time to worry about that now.
Let's figure out how to fly a Star Destroyer,
Solo says, clapping his hands.
Time to properly even the odds. And somebody get on that comm. Make sure those X-Wings don't try to blow us up in the process.
The battle rages for a time. Wedge's Phantom Squadron, comprised of a scattered remnant of washouts, burnouts, and capable freaks, deftly cuts apart the swarms of TIE fighters, though they lose a few. The Falcon flies true, and soon Leia feels like the ship is a part of her. There are even moments when she can feel the battle unfolding around her in space, invisibly, as if all of it is a warm stream in which she has dipped her hand. The Force, she knows, is guiding her. A little bit, at least. Luke will be happy. Eventually, the compromised Dominion begins firing on the others, and the Vitiator breaks in half in a sharp knife slash of light before the vacuum of space crushes what remains.
Your deranged plan worked,
Yvonne says, smirking.
Then maybe it wasn't so deranged.
Oh, no. It was full-bore Moonbat, Princess. They always say it's Han who has the good luck, but I'm starting to think it's you.
The Force was with me today,
she thinks.
But better yet, my friends were here.
And in this galaxy, maybe that's all one truly needs. Akbar's voice fills the air.
The Vitiator is down, and we are receiving a full surrender from the crew of the neutralizer.
Well done, Admiral. And thanks for coming when I called.
Leia called him after she called Wedge. It was a gamble, of course. Akbar could have stopped her, but he came. And because of that, she knows this will cost him. It will cost her, too. And Wedge as well. As it should. This happened outside politics. No vote made this happen. Nobody sanctioned putting these ships and these people at risk. Even Akbar, working with a skeleton crew on board his own ship, and Wedge calling on a stable of forgotten pilots, many thought to be already out to pasture, won't pass easy muster with Mon Mothma. But that is a problem for future Leia. Right now, the Leia of the present is very pleased with herself. And it's time to see her husband. She brings the Falcon in for an easy landing inside of one of the Dominion's hangar bays. A few stormtroopers offer casual resistance, fruitlessly firing their blasters. The Falcon's turrets make short work of them. And with that, Yvonne says,
I'll leave you to it. Give Han a kiss for me. Unless he still has that beard. Because really,
Leia laughs. She steps off the ship. The door at the end of the hangar bay whisks open. A man stands framed by the light behind him. He steps forward, but she already knows who it is. It is her husband, Han Solo. One blaster in each hand. Suddenly there's movement from the side as one of the stormtroopers clambers up over a crate, his rifle aimed right at her. Solo's pistols flash fast. Trooper falls. Han walks toward her. She leans against the Falcon, smiling.
Your worshipfulness?
He yells, seeing her.
Hello, scoundrel.
She calls back in return.
Making me walk the whole hangar, huh?
I like watching you walk.
You okay?
He asks.
I am now. I'm very angry at you, she says.
Hey, I'm angry with you, making me rescue you like this?
Incredulous, she says,
You? Rescue me? This was me rescuing you, you hot-headed, thick-skulled ruffian!
He smirks.
I love you.
She rolls her eyes.
Just kiss me already, you dolt.
He does. They swoop each other up in an embrace so tight, it feels to her that for a moment, they are not only together, but they are one being that will never again be separate. As they pull away, his hand moves to her midriff and holds steady there.
How's our baby?
He's fine.
He? Oh, he's a he now? I told you it'd be a boy, didn't I? We're going to need to think of a name for the little bandit.
Don't you dare say he's going to be a bandit. He'll be an angel.
Nothing wrong with bandits.
nothing wrong with angels.
Kiss me again, he says. And she does.
Chapter 38. Nora gazes out over a sea of people. Thousands of them have gathered here in the plaza to see Chancellor Mon Mothma speak and to hear the stories of those liberated from the prison on Kashyyyk. Next to Nora stands Brenton. She grabs for his hand and gives it a little squeeze and finds his palm slick with sweat. He looks pale. He bites at his lip and stares out over the crowd, but not at the crowd. Rather, he's gazing out at a fixed point in the precise middle of nowhere. She fears she looks the same.
A host of emotions runs through her. Anxiety at having to speak in front of a crowd. The certainty that when she does, she will probably throw up all over her formal naval attire. And finally, worry over Temin, because he's still not here. And that means he may truly be angry with her.
It's not just them on the stage. The Chancellor has stepped out in front of dozens of those liberated from Golas Aram's strange prison ship. And other officials have come too. Senators, generals, admirals. She doesn't see Akbar present, but she does see Commodore Augate, whose face wears that trademark pride and sorrow, both born of war. Nora thinks that she sees General Medine on the end. And next to him, the senator from Chandrila, Durm Harmodius. Quite the company she's keeping. After all, she is a deserter. If she looks over the sea of faces, the plaza is ringed in by the white cliff-like buildings of the Hana city center. And beyond that, the sea. Dead ahead is a series of dark lines, balconies climbing the old gather house like a ladder, all reserved for diplomats, senators, and other emissaries so they can view the day's celebrations. At the very top, she sees the balcony reserved for the Imperial monster, Admiral Ray Sloan. Nora tries not to think about her. She tries not to think about any of it. Not that woman, not Temin, not how she feels like she needs to run away before she pukes. Mon Mothma steps up, flanked by her two advisors, the Togruta Oxy Cray Corbin, and the Chandrillan man, Hostis Idge. On each side and over the heads of the crowd float cam droids, hololenses extended, some snapping static shots with blue flashes, others capturing events as they unfold. Nora tries not to look at those. Mon Mothma steps up to an old stone podium. It's chalky and white, crumbling around the edges, but still surviving the ages.
Hello, Chandrila. Hello, New Republic. And greetings to the galaxy beyond. I am Chancellor Mon Mothma.
Applause erupts. The applause roars, and Temin yells over it to the guard blocking his way into the plaza.
I need to see my mom. She's on stage.
Behind him, Mr. Bones sways back and forth, impatient.
Plaza's full, the guard says as the crowd dies down. You're going to have to wait.
I can't wait. This is important.
I'm sure it is.
Here, the guard steps forward, pushing Temin back a little.
And even still, it's going to have to wait, kid.
I'm not a...
Never mind that.
People may be in danger.
That is an assessment he makes, though he doesn't really know that it's true. He does know that something is up, though. And danger is usually the outcome of this kind of mystery.
Please!
Danger, huh?
The guard pulls a baton off his leg. Its white tip sparks blue. It's a shock lance. He thrusts it toward Temin, not to hit him, but to threaten him with it.
Step back, kid, or I'll use...
A whine of servo motors fills the air as Mr. Bones dances forward, grabbing the guard's arm and twisting it upward. The shock lance jabs hard under the man's golden helmet.
The man cries out, stuttering as he falls. His heels twitch and jump against the ground, though the rest of him is still.
Uh-oh, Temin says.
Threat to Master Temin neutralized.
At least you didn't kill him.
From behind them, shouts reach Temin's ears. And sure enough, here comes a trio of guards. Two with shock lances, one with a blaster.
Come on, Bones!
Mon Mothma speaks.
The citizens on this stage represent the best the galaxy has to offer. Many of them are the original architects of the rebellion, an alliance of like-minded, freedom-seeking worlds who wanted all of us liberated from the leash and collar of an empire that subjugated countless systems, maintaining order through brute force and callous autocracy. That time is over, and the Empire's edge has gone dull.
More applause. Out there in the crowd, Nora sees movement. Her pilot's eye is trained to see such things. In the deep black of space, it's vital to know what light is a star and what is an enemy ship coming out of light speed. Here, it's like seeing a tremor in the gathered throng. She can't quite make out what's happening, but she spies the jostled bodies and the turning heads. The Chancellor continues.
Slowly but surely, the Empire is being pushed back. Planet by planet, system by system. Its time is dwindling, and where it crumbles, the New Republic rises from the ruin to collect the pieces and rebuild what they had damaged. And note that I say damaged, not destroyed. The Empire left us reeling, yes, but what they did was not permanent. The way is not shut. The path forward is clear, and it is ours.
There, someone is cutting through the crowd. She spies the golden helmets of the Senate Guard following after. Wait, it's not someone cutting through the crowd. It's two people. One of them isn't a person. It's a droid. A droid she recognizes.
Mr. Bones.
Oh, no, 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 no. Not now, Temin.
What have you done?
Now she sees him, too. The tousle of hair and a topknot. He looks to her. Their eyes meet. He's yelling something and waving his arms about, but it doesn't matter. The applause is thunderous again, a vibrant roar that swallows all other sound. Sloane stares out over the balcony's edge, her elbows down, her chin resting on steepled fingers. The Chancellor goes on and on. Freedom this, democracy that. Never once acknowledging that the greatest threat the galaxy faces is not from Imperial order, but from its absence. All she can do is hope that the attack will soon commence. She knows Rax will be watching. This entire monkey show is being broadcast across the holonet. Her jaw tightens, and she prays he has this under control.
Commence attack already,
she wishes, as if her thoughts can be broadcast through time and through space.
The time is now.
We have lost many along the way, but today is not a look back at what we've sacrificed, but a look forward to the future,
Mon Mothma says.
A future that we now possess, thanks to those liberated from the Imperial Blacksite Prison. Heroes like Garel's once governor, Jonda J. Tolwar, the Surgeon Council of Hosnian Prime, Plas Leelcott, who helped hide Imperial refugees in his own chateau. The radio operator, Brenton Wexley, from Akiva, who single-handedly transmitted our message across the Outer Rim, and whose own wife, Nora, led the team to rescue him and all these others.
Nora hears her name, but it's a distant sound. a noise lost to the weight of deep water. All she can do is watch her son struggle against the tide of people. She snaps out of it and turns to Brenton to tell him, but what she sees makes no sense. Brenton has his arm up and extended out. In his hand, a small pistol, a 3-shot holdout blaster. He points it right at Chancellor Mon Mothma. Nora screams and grabs his arm, yanking it upward. But it's too late. The blaster fires. No! Temin sees his own father draw something. A matte black pistol, small and concealable. As he points it at the Chancellor, Temin sees that his father is not alone. All the liberated captives have them. His mother sees it too. She grabs for the gun. It goes off, just as someone tackles Temin. Pain coruscates through him as one of the batons jabs hard into his side. His teeth clack, and his tongue feels thick. For a few moments, his body seems like nothing more than a sack of meat, and the guard flips him over. Bones grabs the guard and flings him backward like he's not much more than an old ratty puppet doll. Two more guards advance, and Bones meets them, blades out. A flash of white cloth, and the Chancellor falls. Nora twists Brenton's arm upward so that he can't fire another shot, and he spins to meet her. His face is a mask of horror. It's as if he can't believe what he just did. His mouth is open in a hopeless O, eyes glistening with tears. He mouths, "I'm sorry." Then he drives a knee into her stomach. "Brenton!" she cries. He slams the gun down on the back of her head, and she drops. Nora rolls over, groaning. The stage is chaos. She realizes now, only too late, how her husband is not alone in his act. The other captives also have pistols up and out, and they're firing at those gathered on stage and into the crowd. Searing bolts cross open space. Someone falls near her. One of the Chancellor's own advisors, Hostis, drops hard on his side, a serpent of smoke rising from a cooked hole in his head. Nora strains to look around her. Brenton is nowhere. Panic is everywhere. One of the liberated steps in front of her. It's the first one the Chancellor mentioned. Jonda J. Talwar. A tall woman with white hair. Her face is a mask of unrecognizable rage as she fires into the crowd. Nora grabs the woman's leg and yanks hard. The traitor cries out and drops onto her back, the air blasting out of her lungs. It takes little effort to twist the pistol out of her grip. On the woman's face, an odd moment of clarity passes in front, like a cloud clearing away from the sun. She says something, something that's hard to hear over the sound of blasters and screams and thundering crowds. Something that might be, "What have I done?" Nora doesn't know how to answer her. The only answer she can supply is a straight fist to the woman's nose. Jay Talwar's eyes flutter, and she goes unconscious. Nora gets up, then almost falls. A fresh starburst of pain radiates out from the base of her skull, where Brenton hit her. Her vision goes double, then triple, then blurry once more. Ahead, she sees a white, crumpled shape. Mon Mothma, still on the ground. And ahead is Commodore Augate, wrestling with one of the liberated. A Rodian man waving a pistol. Nora staggers toward them. The pistol goes off. Augate's head snaps back. She screams, rocking hard against the podium, as the Rodian man lifts the gun, aiming to finish the job. Nora now recognizes him as Ezdo, once a senator's aide from Coruscant, before ending up locked away in that prison ship. She rushes him, slamming him back. He falls. She kicks the gun away. Agate is clutching at her face. Between the fingers, Nora sees the dark char and blistered skin.
Go!
Agate hisses.
Get clear!
Nora nods. Ahead, she sees the Taruta woman, Oxen, helping Mon Mothma up. She's not dead, Nora thinks. A small bit of good news on this dire, dread day. The Chancellor's shoulder is wet with red.
Guards swarm the stage, firing stun blasts at the scattering liberated captives.
Nora doesn't see Brenton anywhere. She needs to find him. Now!
The epiphany that Sloane experiences is not one she expects, nor is it one she desires. As she watches the events unfold down below her balcony, she realizes grimly, this is the attack Rax was planning. His fingerprints are all over it. How, she doesn't know. These rebels who returned from the prison have been programmed in some way, turned into traitors, changed into killers. It is genius. And it disgusts her. She says as much to Adia, standing behind her, even as Sloane cannot tear her eyes away from the chaos below.
This is not war,
she says, her voice drawn out and ragged.
This is not battle. This is something else.
A test, says a small voice inside her.
This is not how we conduct ourselves. This is how they do it. Insurgency and terror.
These were not the events Sloane figured she would witness today. Where are the ships? Where is her fleet scouring Chandrilla with sacred Imperial fire?
But here it is, and deal with it she must. Mothma left her and Adia up here with a guard contingent, treating Sloane like an honored guest, but still taking precautions. Sloane turns. 5 new Republic guards remain, and 2 of her own, the red-cloaked royal guardsmen, stand silent and still. Adia hovers nearby, trembling just slightly. To the 2 royal guards, Sloane gives a gentle nod. The guards of the New Republic have no chance. Those picked to serve Palpatine and wear the elite red cloaks are blank soldiers, filled only with the knowledge of how to defend and how to kill. A swoosh of their cloaks and a spin of the blades, and in less than 10 seconds, the bodies of the fallen Republic guards litter the floor. Sloane tells those red cloaks,
go, clear the way and secure my ship. Adia and I will be along shortly thereafter.
They say nothing. They do not even offer a nod. They simply do as commanded.
We need a plan, Sloane says to Adia.
As you said, the guards will clear the way.
No,
Sloane says with a sharp rebuke.
A larger plan. This aberration of an attack must not become our dominant mode of doing business, Adia. We must deal with Rax quickly, mercilessly. If he is given time, he will spin this as only he can. He will attempt to convince the others that it was sensible, a necessary evil.
What if they do? Surely the New Republic will be left reeling.
Sloane turns and again looks out over the balcony. Now she sees guards swarming the stage. The Chancellor is up and disappearing in a circle of protectors.
So, Mon Mothma is alive. Good. That woman must not die. She must kneel in fealty. That is the only fate Sloane will accept for the foolish Chancellor.
Don't be seduced by Rax,
Sloane says, still watching below. Madness has seized the crowd beyond.
I was. Temporary idiocy on my part. I became complacent. And now, this happened. We should have brought the fleet. We need to demonstrate martial ability. The Empire is a hammer striking down disorder, not a knife slipped between unsuspecting ribs. Rax must be arrested, and then executed. I will be the one to do it.
Adia says nothing. The silence from her is deafening. And then comes the second unwanted epiphany.
Adia,
Sloane says, turning toward her assistant. Her assistant stands there, one of the guard's own blaster rifles in her hand. Its barrel points right at Sloane's head. Adia isn't trembling anymore. She is firm-footed and sure of her actions.
Sloane sighs. Not her. Please, not her. I'm too late, aren't I? We were both fools, Adia.
Rax is the way forward. The Empire must be willing to change. We must be willing to do anything to show the galaxy what it is to defy us.
Don't point that weapon at me, Adia.
This was a test. He wanted you to embrace it, to see things his way. It didn't have to be like this. You could have helped him rule, and I would be with you both, helping reshape the Empire and the galaxy beyond.
I do not want the Empire reshaped by his hands. And I don't want you reshaped by him either. We worked well together, you and I. You trusted in my vision, didn't you?
Now, though she understands, Adia has been betraying her all along, hasn't she? Giving intel on her to Rax. It's how he knew where she was on Coruscant. How he knew about her meeting with Mos Amita. About everything. Maybe there's still hope.
Put that rifle down.
I'll give you no more chances, Adia. Put it down.
But Adia does no such thing. She is resolute. She is his. So be it.
Sloane faints left, then moves right. Adia isn't combat trained. The rifle follows Sloane's first movement and fires. The blaster bolt tears through the space where Sloane was moments before. Sloane drives a fist into Adia's kidneys. The girl cries out, tries to wheel on Sloane with the rifle, which is exactly the wrong thing to do. Sloane easily pivots the weapon out of the girl's hands and fires a bolt,
point blank into her chest. Adia's eyes go wide, and in them, Sloane sees a young woman she trusted. A woman she thought could have been her daughter in another lifetime. Adia's lips work soundlessly. She falls.
Sloane takes a moment. And in that moment, rage surges through her like acid.
I am going to kill Gallius Rax.
Sloane leaves the room, rifle in her hand.
Brenton!
Nora fights against the crowd. They're panicked. They should be. She is too. From somewhere she hears someone weeping. Then more blaster fire. She tries to imagine what happened, and what is happening even still. But she can't get her head around it. To see these captives held up on a well-deserved pedestal, only to turn around and attack, is incomprehensible.
Brenton! Her husband is part of it. He tried to assassinate the Chancellor. Who else would he have attacked if she hadn't stopped him? And where did he go? She has to find him. To stop him, yes, but also to understand what happened.
To look in his eyes once more and try to find out if the man who did this thing is still her husband, or if her husband is even there at all.
Brenton, why?
She fights her way across the plaza, looking for her husband, but also looking for her son. Temin knew. He tried to warn her.
Now, where is he? Get higher.
She's a pilot. She needs height, like a falcon scouting for prey. She pushes her way through to the old gather house, then laps a couple of steps,
almost running out of breath as she does.
She sees a body in the hall, an Odigan senator, eyes as glassy and dead as a droid's.
That means more captives were here too, doesn't it? Of course they were. They weren't all on stage. Some of them were probably here, watching.
waiting.
Nora moves on. Nothing to be done here. She finds her way to one of the now empty terraces. The crowd has already started to disperse below, and the guards are locking down the plaza.
Good. Hopefully they'll catch as many of these people as they can.
Someone needs to get answers.
And then, Nora sees him. Brenton Wexley, to the far right of the plaza. He's crossing one of the sky bridges, heading in the direction of the landing platforms.
Nora grits her teeth and moves in that direction.
Stop!
Temin stands behind his father as the man flees to the end of the sky bridge. Beyond, hundreds of landing platforms ring the far side of Hana City, and beyond them waits the sea. His father, pistol still in hand, freezes. Temin has no weapon. He's alone, too. Bones is gone, left back in the crowd to distract the guards so that Temin could flee. Slowly, Brenton turns around.
Tem,
Dad says. It sounds like Dad. His voice wavers.
Mom was right. You aren't you.
I am. But...
His father's words die on the vine before bearing fruit. He just stands there. Then he slowly raises the pistol. Almost as if he doesn't want to. As if something is lifting his arm. An invisible string tugging on his wrist. Or maybe Temin is just imagining that. Maybe Dad wants to kill him. Either way, Temin stands there, chin up and out, trying not to cry, and failing miserably, because he feels his cheeks tighten and his eyes go wet. He has no weapon to point, so instead, he points an accusing finger.
You killed people!
Don't say that!
You did! You're the Empire. Were you always... Was it all just a lie? Playing the good guys so we didn't know how bad you were?
No! No! I was... I never...
Shoot me. Go ahead. You shot me once.
The gun wavers. Brenton fights against it. The struggle is plain on his face, like he's battling himself. The pistol shakes violently in his hand as the arm bends at the elbow, slowly pointing the gun at his own head.
No!
Temin cries, bolting hard across the open space. He leaps, tackling his father as the blaster goes off. The gun clatters against the empty bridge. Brenton stares up at him with empty eyes.
No, 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 don't die!
Those eyes blink. Oh, the shot missed. Temin got there in time. And now Brenton is alive. His father cries out and pistons a fist into Temin's stomach. He shoves the boy off him and then flees, leaving his son behind, gasping for air and sobbing there on the sky bridge.
Dad.
The guard with a cresting wave of blonde hair and a little scar on the bottom of his chin stands there, staring down. Yup Tashu, once advisor to Emperor Palpatine, looks up, his chin slick with his own spit.
Hello, guard,
Tashu says, mush-mouthed. The guard drops the gate, keeping Tashu imprisoned.
Here to kill me?
Tashu asks. Then his words dissolve into mad laughter. His laughter becomes coughing, his body racked with spasms until he's left curled into a ball. He gasps for air and then says,
I heard blaster fire. You heard correctly, but you are not a target. Then what am I? A free man.
More laughter rises out of him, and more lung spasms after.
The darkness has saved me. Long have I pleaded with it. You may go. There is a ship waiting. Docking platform E-22. And the other guests? Shale, and Crassus, and Pandion? Pandion died, you fool. And now the others have joined him.
Tashu stands on quaking bird legs.
You murdered them?
I did.
Why?
Because I was told to. Just as I was told to free you.
And who told you this, God?
Our new emperor. You are to serve him now.
Tashu's lip quivers. Palpatine was his everything. To serve someone else feels treasonous beyond the pale. The void awaits those who betray Palpatine. That much has always been clear. A void awaits traitors.
I only serve Palpatine.
Emperor Rax serves Palpatine too. Now go.
Tashu nods.
Yes. Yes, it makes sense. It's part of a plan, isn't it? A plan I couldn't see. Sidious always had a plan.
He cackles one last time, then hurries past the guard, lest the strange man change his mind at the last moment.
I am free at last.
Blast it! Nora is lost. The old gather house is a maze. She thought she could cut through the center and come out on the seaside facing the landing platforms. But this is an old building. Some of it is new, yes, but much of it was where the first settlers on Chandrilla gathered to sleep, to eat, to meet. They lived whole lives here. And this building was not all built at once, but rather one strata at a time. And now, Nora is wandering its channels. Sure, she's doubling back on herself. Oh, didn't she just see that light panel? That crack in the wall? That same painting of the first Polis meeting? She spins around, finds a door. She hasn't tried this one yet, has she? Nora hits the panel next to it with the heel of her hand. It shushes open, and Nora nearly runs into somebody.
You,
Nora says.
You,
Admiral Sloane says. Nora straight punches her in the face. Sloane is rocked, but recovers quickly, even as a line of blood crawls from her nose like a fleeing worm. The Admiral licks at the blood, then brings up a blaster rifle, firing it. But Nora rolls to the other side of the door, even as the air around her heats up, laser bolts popping craters in the far wall. This is it. This is her chance. All her anger and fear refines to a laser focus. Because, of course, Sloane is here. That monster did all of this. What Brenton did on stage was not his own action. It was Sloane. She's the puppet master pulling strings. A sudden sinkhole of regret opens up inside Nora's gut. Because if she had just done her job and killed this woman when she had a chance, none of this would have happened. At least she can finish what she started. Sloane comes through the door, rifle out. Nora drives her knee under the blaster, and the barrel of it whips back and catches Sloane in the face. The woman blinks, then ducks low and hard charges into Nora. It's like getting hit by a grav train. The movement carries her against the far wall, and her skull snaps back into the mortar, blasting new fireworks behind her eyes. Again, she sees Sloane point the rifle. Nora catches the barrel with her hands and points it away. More bolts take chunks out of the wall. Dust streams and flecks of stone rain into her hair and her eyes. She has no focus, and she feels dizzied. So all she can do is harness her anger and use brute force. A loud guttural cry is ripped out of her as Nora yanks the rifle from Sloane's grasp. It gives way with such force, It falls from her own hands, spinning away on the stone floor. She lunges after it, but she can't reach it. Sloane catches Nora's collar and pulls her back just as her fingers find the cold steel of the rifle barrel. The Imperial whirls Nora hard into the wall, then drives a flurry of hard punches into her side. One after another after another. Nora tries to fight against it, but she's not practiced at this. Not at hand to hand. And this woman attacks with the tenacity of an orbital strike.
I remember you, Sloane seethes. You should be dead. So should you,
Nora gasps, then whips her head to the side, ratcheting her skull against the other woman's chin. It gives her room to move, room to breathe, room to feel like she's not about to die. She doesn't rest long. Nora launches herself bodily at the woman. The Imperial meets her with fists up, absorbing every blow Nora throws. So instead, Nora goes for the dirty play. She stabs out with a foot and catches the Imperial Admiral in the knee. The leg goes backward, and Sloane cries out. Yet even that doesn't end it. Nora's head rocks, and she tastes blood as her lip splits under an assaulting fist. Another hit closes her eye behind fast-swelling bruise flesh. She throws her own clumsy fist, and Sloane ducks it, pumping a return fist into Nora's gut.
She gags and staggers.
Sloane grabs her by a hank of her ashen hair and bangs Nora's head into the wall once, twice, three times. Every time, she feels her brain rattle in her skull. Sharp shocks of light flashing as her teeth clack and her tongue tastes fresh blood.
I'm losing. I'm dying. I failed.
Stop right there! A voice echoes down the hall. A woman's voice. And then the sound of blaster fire fills her ears. Nora drops, sliding against the wall, as Sloane bolts, and Senate guards hurry after her, firing their weapons. Sloane curses under her breath. She wasted too much time scrapping with that pilot. That woman is meaningless, and yet she stopped to fight her. Why? Anger taunted her, distracted her. Now she's on the run from guards in a building whose layout is labyrinthine. Her nose might be broken. One of her teeth.